is because this is a transition class between really basic introductory physics and sort of your higher level classes, I am going off topic or deeper in some places than Jay Tully does, or I'll try to do some things that go a bit beyond. So in some instances, I may expect you to actually really get that stuff and be able to do it on an exam. And I have to be clear with you when that is and make sure you have appropriate materials to study and do some problems. Okay. Sometimes I'll be doing it and I'm really doing it so that you've seen it before and you'll get it more in higher level classes, but my expectations aren't that you do it on tests. So one of the issues that I have to do is to try to figure out what those things are and delineate that for you. So I will attempt to do that. I can't guarantee it will be perfect, but that's what we're going to try to do. That said, if you paid any attention, you already realized in the syllabus that we have that we're already pushing it behind. Right? We're doing ways. So part of that is because I think it's worthwhile to do more ways. So just be aware that that syllabus is tentative and there's some expansion time at the end, and then we'll probably end up using some of it. So any questions about that kind of stuff? So generally, what I have to do is decide basically the material coverage will probably be through next week's problem set and next week's workshop. Or I may cut it off somewhere in the problem set for next week, because I generally like to only cover on exams things that you've actually had a chance to work with in the workshop. Okay? Okay, so last time we were talking about some of the really fundamental characteristics of waves that make them fascinating. One is energy flow, those is amplitude squared. And we derived a more complicated form, and there may be times when we actually have to do a calculation and you have to use the full-blown form. But what I was really after, the intuition I want you to have, is that the energy flow tends to go with amplitude squared. The other thing, and probably the single most important characteristic of waves that makes them so interesting for a lot of things, is that they exhibit superposition. So if I have n different waves, in different things that satisfy the wave equation, say if two of them, side one, side two, then the sum of those things will satisfy the wave equation. A way to think about it is as waves pass through each other, they just basically add together linearly. So if I have two waves traveling on a string and they happen to have these bizarre pulses and phases, right? And as time passes, when they reach each other, they just add together in a strange sort of way. But that's, well, I guess as simple as they can possibly do it. And that's really what we need is superposition. And then they basically pass through each other. It's as if they maintain their own integrity, but they will add together anyway. All right. So let us imagine that we have a famous rock band. You think the real beginning of the British rock invasion was Isaac Newton. I found it on the web. So you've got sound being produced, and let's say that you are a fan and you are 10 meters from the nearest speaker, and there's one other speaker that happens to be in line with the first that's a half meter behind it. So here's the question. What frequencies will our rock fan and physics group not hear well as the music is played? And this is under the assumption that he hasn't been to so many concerts that he can't hear anyway. Right, so in the limit that he has a perfect hearing, perfect human hearing, so that means he has some sensitivity in these range of frequencies. Given the speed of sound is this, think for a minute about how you would do this. this problem? How would you set that up? Is an integral wavelength plus a half, so that they're out of phase, then you'll get destructive interference. Okay? So, to be quantitative, I just went ahead and converted these to meters just to have some idea of what kind of wavelength we're talking about for the sound that you can hear. Here are your two paths, call that V1, V2. When this difference differs by a full wavelength, then you have constructive interference because both waves are going to be with the same phase. So you need to take that distance, this difference has to be that distance, and then you have to add half a wavelength. I add the half a wavelength because basically you don't want it to be a negative distance. Anyway, so if I call this difference d, then that distance has to be an integral plus a half wavelength. The wavelength you can rewrite as the velocity of the frequency. We were given the velocity. So I can now pull the frequency over, put the d down, and the frequencies where you'll have destructive interference will be given by this formula. Okay? And so then you can just substitute in the various m's. So here I substitute m equals 0, m equals 1, m equals 2, and those particular frequencies you want to get over here. Okay? So if you find yourself memorizing any formula like this, totally go in front of the mirror and just start slapping yourself or something. Okay? That is not how you do these problems. You have to think through them this way. The only circumstance under which you would memorize it is if I gave you the identical problem. And I can guarantee you that I won't do that. Well, guarantee may be a strong word. I may forget what I told you in class and end up giving you the same problem. But if it happens, it's by accident. Okay, so I will give you something that, as far as I know, I have not given you before. It will not necessarily be way more complex than this, but you'll have to think your way through it. Okay? And just get good at it, because you're going to see, if you haven't already seen it in optics, you're going to see it out the wazoo, because you have the same sorts of things for light. Have you done thin film interference in optics? Okay, have you ever noticed, for example, that when the paparazzi are after you and you look at the lens, it looks dark or dark blue? No? Ah, you guys aren't famous enough. jump. Next time, if you look at somebody's binoculars typically, they're like a deep dark blue. It's like there's nothing reflected from them. The same is true for camera lenses, good camera lenses. And they do that by putting a coating on the lens such that as the light comes in, let's imagine here's the surface of the glass, and here is the surface of the coating. As light comes in, you'll get some reflecting here and some reflecting here. And if this distance for the light wave is an integral plus a half a wavelength, then you get destructive interference right at that surface, and you have no light reflecting. Which, if you're trying to sneak up on bad guys with your binoculars, is really important, right? It also happens to mean that you get full transmission, so it actually also allows more light to come in. It's a little bit harder to sort of grasp, because you're talking about reflection and reflection, and yet your transmission is 100% because you have more reflection. Yes?
Does that only work for one frequency?
Yeah, so part of the game is to set up the coatings so that it's in the right place. One frequency, yes, but you know, there's a range over which it sort of works. So you would put that range right at the set of frequencies you most want to keep from reflecting. And so the truth is, if you have it set up so that it doesn't reflect in the visible, it might be glowing like crazy in the ultraviolet or something, you know. So. Anyway, so you'll see this kind of thing. So, also last time we looked at a fun example of wave interference. In this case, we take two waves, and we have them with the same amplitude, but we set them up with different frequencies, and we just see what happens when we add them together. And so when you add two sine waves together with the same amplitudes, you can use a trigonometric identity, and I'm not expecting you to have those all at your fingertips, and rewrite this in terms of this. And when you rewrite this in terms of this and look at it a little bit, then out comes the interesting stuff. So what you see is that there is a sine term which has a frequency that's the average of these two frequencies. And then you have a cosine term that's the difference of those frequencies. So we did a demo where we had two tuning forks that had slightly different frequencies. And what you heard was the average of those two frequencies, but your ear probably couldn't distinguish between either one of them because they weren't very different. So you're hearing this, and then this piece times this piece act as an amplitude, and that amplitude varies in time with a frequency that is low because omega 2 minus omega 1 is very close together. And remember, the amplitude is a measure of energy flow or intensity. So what you heard was the sound being modulated in intensity. So it was going right? And there's a range over which this sort of makes sense. You really can't perceive it if this frequency difference is too big or too small, right? If it's too big, then it's going to then it will go so fast you cannot hear that modulation anymore. If it becomes that difference becomes too small, then the modulation is wah, and it takes so long you don't even perceive the modulation that happened. Okay. And so you can actually tell something about the difference in the frequencies by that modulation frequency. And if you're doing things like tuning an instrument, you can change one of the strings. You can tighten it up, raising its frequency, for example, and then see if that modulation frequency is increasing or decreasing, and that will tell you which direction you have to go to make it play the same note as the other string. Yeah.
So when you're tuning a violin, if you're getting spaces with a perfect width apart, musically, advisor, but the fees are only 1 second for that material, because you can always do that work, or just, you don't need to rush.
I don't play by them, so I'm not going to be able to give you a very good answer. But basically, what you want to do, let's assume we're not looking for a beat frequency that's 1 second, but we're looking for a beat frequency that you can't hear, that is so slow that you can't hear it. So you tighten it up, and it would be very fast, blah, 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 blah. And then you would know that you're, and as it gets faster, you know that omega 2 and omega 1 are getting further away. So you would go the other direction until you basically lose it the other way, where it's so slow you don't hear it. And at that point, you would not be able to distinguish the frequency difference. So that would be a way of roughly tuning one string to the other string. Since they have to be a certain amount apart, or I guess if they all play the same note, it's probably less than an interesting instrument, I guess. I don't know what you do, right? Do you touch it and change the length of that string and try to get those two to match, or something like that?
I get as you're listening to it, and so you can a little pitch, and you're trying to get the strings to be better than the short frequency.
Okay.
But I don't know why that.
I don't know. I'll look it up and put a problem on the exam, and we'll all figure it out together. Something like that. I don't know. I wish I was a musician, actually. There are some interesting things about this. I guess a couple stories. One, I was on the faculty at Yale many years ago, and I was walking from one part of campus to another, and just all hell broke loose with a thunderstorm. And I basically had to run to the nearest doorway. And it was really raining like crazy, so I literally went inside. And when I went inside, there was this guy who was really happy to see me. I guess he didn't get any visitors. It turns out this is a historical musical instrument library at Yale. And it was really raining like crazy, so I was a bit trapped, and this guy was clearly bored, and so he took me on a tour, which was absolutely fascinating. And it was very cool. So what you hear with instruments is not just what we're really describing. I mean, that's the pitch, and that is important. But you also hear something called quality, which probably the musicians here can describe better than I do, but it's sort of the sound that you hear that's a little bit... that has to do with how the instrument resonates as a whole. And it can actually change depending on those materials that are vibrating and the glues and the things that you use. So in this musical instrument museum, they restored the instruments with exactly the materials that were used historically at the time when those instruments were used. So what I found actually fascinating was that this changes the sounds of the instruments if you use different materials and different glues and things like that. So that every now and then they would actually have concerts where they would, and then they happen here too in the MAG, I'm not sure, but they would have concerts, of a sort of period concerts, where they would play the pieces as they would have sounded when Beethoven or Tchaikovsky or whoever actually wrote the piece. And it actually sounds different. It's sort of cool that way. David, I don't know if a musician wants to add anything to that.
There's another sort of fun thing that I wanted to mention while I was doing this problem. I once had it was actually a scary
example of interference happening. I went to a collaborator on an experiment at Brookhaven many years ago, and we had a collaboration meeting, Brookhaven National Lab. And this meeting was in the chemistry department at Brookhaven National Lab. Now, you're a bunch of science geeks, so some of you may end up at Brookhaven, and you may end up at a function in this particular auditorium. So if you do, I want you to check this out. So I wandered in this meeting, and everybody was sort of this little murmur and everything, and I sat down at some seat like right over here. And then the guy up front started talking. And when he was talking, I heard... And, you know, I was like... And then I got this jolt of adrenaline, because I'm like, holy shit, I just lost my hearing. Because literally, I could hear nothing this guy was saying. And it really scared me. And then I thought about it for a second, and I got up and I moved two seats forward, and I heard him just talk. It was really bizarre. So it was a really horrible auditorium. Have you ever wondered, I mean, this stuff isn't up here just to make this room horribly ugly. Right? It's up there for a reason. And the reason is, in auditoriums, you'll see all sorts of weird structures in the ceiling. You know, look, that's not even. You have lots of weird shapes. And the reason for that is because if you're in a really bad auditorium, then you'll have sound coming at you with one path, and then maybe one other path that dominates. And if those two are out of phase, you don't hear anything. So you have dead zones in that auditorium. So what you have are things like this that, I mean, this is soft, so it probably soaks up certain frequencies so that, you know, the auditorium is not as noisy overall. But also you'll notice the shapes are all different, and the shapes up here are different. And that way, wherever you sit, you have sounds coming to you from a bunch of different paths, so you don't just have interference, dead zones, and stuff. So if you're in a really bad auditorium, you may notice that. But that was the only time I've ever experienced it so dramatically. So if you ever end up at Brookhaven in the chemistry department at some function in their basic auditorium, I want you to sort of walk back and forth up and down the aisle. Unless they fixed it, it was unbelievable. And you could actually get the success of dead zones. I mean, it was really bizarre. It was like I could walk and I'd be hearing well, hearing not at all, hearing well, hearing not at all. All of them down on the side. Very bizarre. Okay. Any questions? Yes?
If what you hear is the average or squeeze, any idea how it could be your core and stuff?
So chord would be different things playing all at once, right?
Yeah.
Well, I haven't really, you know, when we do this, we say that these are very, I mean, the beat piece only really seems to happen if these are fairly close or not. So I guess if they are not so close, you're going to hear the two different strings playing their resonant frequencies, that's clear. Okay.
Between, you know, about this level and putting the CD in the player is about my musical abilities, so I haven't really thought about it beyond that. All right, what are we going to do here? Okay. So I wanted to say a few words about waves and boundaries. It turns out that a lot of the really interesting things happen with waves when you have boundary conditions. You put them in a box, you tie them between rods.
I was going to say, with the chord, if you play it first in the fifth, you can hear the third sometimes.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Okay. So, how cool is that? Okay. Well, you guys are doing music now. It's never going to be the same for you, because you need to start thinking about this stuff every time you start messing with it. And we're going to do more right now. So let's look at boundaries.
Okay. So as you might imagine, if I have a wave moving, say, along the string, and this string has certain mastery and length characteristics, right? And it's going along. If all of a sudden it hits a much heavier string, then the wave
basically is going to transmit a little, but it's also going to have to reflect some, because this wave is basically moving faster than this can move. So you're going to have sort of a weird situation happening. If you have something heavy and it's moving, then it will hit the light and move it very easily. Okay, so the speeds will change, but also we can have relative phase changes when this happens.
So let's look at this a little bit. Let's suppose that we have a heavy rope tied to a fairly light rope. And what you might imagine is, let's say we have an incoming wave pulse coming down this rope. When it hits the interface, it will continue on, and we call this the transmitted wave. And this we'll call the incoming wave.
And at any interface between media or anything a wave is moving in, we'll just sort of call media. If you hit the interface, you will have transmission and reflection in the most general case. So if this is really a heavy, slow-moving medium, you might think of it as, when it hits the light medium, it's sort of like it doesn't notice it very much. So the wave that goes through will have the same phase and just continue on. And to the extent that you have any reflection, it will have the same phase as the incoming wave, because this can't affect it very much. Okay?
And we call that the reflected wave. If I have a situation where I have a light string, or light rope, a light medium, or slow medium, and you then encounter a heavy medium, here's our incoming wave. You will have a transmitted wave that continues with the same phase. The amplitudes may change as well, and one of the things you'll eventually study is exactly how the amplitude of the reflected and transmitted waves depends on the characteristics of the interface or the angle that you hit it in or lots of other things. But now, in this case, this wave is coming in, and to some extent, when it hits this heavy thing, it doesn't want to move. It's a little bit like it hits a wall. So that means the piece that reflects more or less has to add with the incoming wave here to give you an amplitude of roughly zero, because it's as if it can't move, so you're sort of defining this point as not moving at that moment. So that means the reflected wave basically bounces back with a 180-degree phase shift, because the two have to add together to give you something approximately or close to looking like it might be zero. It's not completely like a wall, so they don't completely cancel each other out. But what you'll find is that when you go from a fast medium to a slow medium, or something as light as something heavy in terms of how it moves with respect to the wave, the reflected wave comes off with a 180-degree phase difference.
Okay? Yes.
What exactly does phase mean?
phase is the argument of the harmonic function. So if you think of this as your, let's call it a pulse, but consider it as, say, it's a sign, okay? And let's say you freeze your eyes on that pulse. Think of it as one of the humps in the sine curve. The condition of constant phase would be this thing moving. You would just, your eyes fixed on that, that would be that piece moving. So if I change the phase of the harmonic function, I'm literally sliding the function up and down the x, y, from the x. It's a function of x. So if I sit at one point, and I allow x to be fixed, but in the sine function of the wave, I allow time to change, the phase, the argument of that harmonic function changes with time harmonically with time, right? So that's why, I mean, that piece is just simple harmonic. So a piece on the wave where you could fix x moves up and down, and mathematically what you're doing, you're varying that argument of the harmonic function, and that's what we call the phase.
So when you say on a 180-degree phase shift, you're moving 180 degrees forward on.
Yeah, that means I'm shifting it by pi. So it means that if for the moment this is what you have, if I shift it by 180 degrees, it looks like that. Okay. Here's the sine is red, the cosine is blue, they differ by 90 degrees, so they're 90 degrees out of phase, is a way of saying it. Okay, if I shift the argument in the harmonic function by pi over 2, I can do that by just changing the sine to a cosine or the cosine to a sine. Okay? You're on the heavier cable, you hit the lighter cable.
Yeah.
Wouldn't you expect it to act the same way? You mean keep the same orientation or the same phase as you propagate through it?
I mean, act the same way as it does when you're going from the lighter to the heavier. Have some reflection.
Yes, it will have some reflection, but it doesn't have a phase shift.
Why not?
Because the heavy piece will dominate the motion of the two pieces. If you think about just that interface between the light and the heavy, if the heavy's moving up, the light is going to move up with it. So whatever gets reflected starts from that boundary condition. If I have light going to heavy, then it's like I hit a wall. And so the reflected piece basically has to cancel out to some extent what the light one is doing. And conceptually, I'm trying to... Alright. So... let's see what happens. I'm going to hold this tightly. Up high. Alright. So we'll just see how. It's hard to see when you go from heavy to light because it moves a lot faster once it's on the light. So do you see that when it hits the light, one, it moves very fast because the string is now, the mass gradient length is now much less. The other is, as it moves, it keeps the same orientation. You see that? Sort of. I have a better dinner for that. That's okay. But let's see if this is better. Hold that in. Actually, shorten it up. Now you can hope see that when I go from light to heavy, it keeps the same. It's a little bit hard to see what's going back the other way. So this doesn't work so great, but I do have a much better demo, which isn't strange, which is how I like to introduce it. And I'm totally... Okay, what I have is a different type of wave here, a medium of bars, if you can see them. Sorry. I have bars. I have long bars on your left and shorter bars on the right. These bars are all connected to a stiff wire. Okay? So what's going to happen is if I wiggle one of these, it twists the wire a little bit, which gives the connection between these bars. If you have things that move and they have a connection to the things next to them, you get a wave, right? So, let's look at what happens, if you can see this. When I send a wave from a heavy, slow medium, that is, it's harder to move these bars than it is these light ones. So this would be a heavy and slow medium. This would be a light medium. So one of the things you're going to see is that the wave is going to move slow here, and then much faster here, because the connection between these two things, that force, is going to move these faster because they have less mass holding them. See that? Slow, fast. Okay? Now, what I'd like you to do is to think about what's happening with the orientation of the wave, the phase of the wave, as it hits this interface and is transmitted. Okay? It's up, and this maintains the same orientation as it goes past. Got that? Alright. Now what I'd like you to do is, as this wave comes in, I want you to try to pay attention to whatever's reflected at this interface. See that? What phase did it have? It stays up. Okay? Now we're going to come in from the light side to the heavy side. First of all, you see how fast this goes, and then it's slow as it goes through. But notice that the phase of the transmitted wave is the same. It stays up. Right? Now, I want you to try to see the phase of the reflected wave at this interface, the one that goes back this way. Side up, and you can see it very nicely, and the reflected wave starts in those conditions. Starts there, and then it goes back when it's held up. Look at what happens when this thing hits and it reflects. This point doesn't actually move very much because it's the incoming wave this way, and the outgoing wave have to cancel out because this stuff doesn't want to move very fast. Heavy stuff. You see that? This moves, but not much. And if you're able to see it, it's a little hard to see because it goes back. But this reflected wave comes in with the phase flow. Alright? class, you can come play with it a little if you want. You laugh.
But you know you got the geek bug when you're like, yeah, I'm going to go play with that. Okay. It's cool. Okay. So, to summarize, this is true for all media. If basically you have a situation where you're going from slow to fast or heavy to light, then you'll have no phase change upon reflection. And if you reflect upon that, I'm sure it will make sense. Slow, too fast, or low, mu to, I'm sorry, I'm going backwards. High mu to low mu, high rho to small rho for sound, right? Some different things. Then you have no phase change. If you go from fast to slow, or from low mu to high mu, then you'll get a 180 degree phase change. Yes?
Is that true for the super
refraction? Yep. When you reflect off of, when you're going from a low index of refraction to high index of refraction, you'll get 180 degree phase change when you go from high to low. It's the same kind of stuff. What happens with the index of refraction is you're literally varying the permittivity and permeability of the substance, so the light wave actually, again, travels different speeds. So it's effectively the same stuff. Which we'll do in gory detail a little later in the course, but that's the answer to your question. Okay. So now what I'd like to do is to consider what happens if we have waves on a string. We've already talked about this a bit, but what this means is if I have a string that is tied at one end, and I have a wave coming in, over a function of time, as this wave begins to hit, this thing is continuing on in. The reflective wave is traveling back out with the opposite phase, and they have to cancel out at that point. So I'll end up with the 180 degree phase change. So this would be reflection at a fixed boundary. Okay, but if you have a situation where you have a boundary, but in fact, for example, the string is allowed to move. So the string maybe is terminated on a frictionless ring that moves up and down a rod, for example. Then you might have the wave coming in. And now when the wave hits, it just moves the rod, or the ring up the rod. Because you don't have the boundary condition of having zero amplitude where it's tied. Okay? So now, the reflected wave is going to come back with the same phase. Oops, that's not going to look so bad.
Okay? Yeah. I mean, if you have a true pulse like that, I think so. Oops. Didn't mean to do that yet. Okay. So now what I'd like to do is to consider a string which is fixed at two ends. Sort of like what we have here. And I can send a pulse however I want, right? And you can get some random jumble of stuff happening on this string. So let us think about having a wave that travels to the right, okay? And it will reflect off of the other interface, or the, where it's held, and it will then travel to the left. Wave superimposed. So we're going to consider waves of the same frequency traveling two different directions. And that will basically be approximated by what we see here. So let us have... So to examine this, let's say that we have y1 of xt to be one of these waves. And let's say that it goes as a sine kx minus omega t because it's moving in the positive x direction. And then what I'd like to do is to superimpose this with a reflected wave. And that reflected wave... we will call y2 of xt. We'll say it has the same amplitude times the, because it's reflecting back into the same medium, so it's not, the amplitude isn't changed. We want it to move the other direction, so we'll have kx plus omega t, and then there'll be some phi angle. So in this case, we want to reflect from a fixed tied end. So phi equals pi, because we want to flip it. And then I want to make use of the fact that a times the sine of x plus pi is equal to minus a times the sine of x. So if that's true, then it means this and that says that y2 of xt can be rewritten as minus a times the sine of kx plus omega t. Okay? Now what I want to do is to just add these two together. So we'll use superposition. And so the wave that we would see on the string, we'll just call y of xt, is equal to y1 plus y2, so that'll be a times the sine kx minus omega t minus a times the sine of kx plus omega t. Okay? And now, because we were all born knowing this, I'm going to use a trig ID. And the one I want to pull out of thin air this time is that sine of C plus sine of B is equal to 2 times the sine of 1/2 C plus B times the cosine of 1/2 C minus B, which I guess may be the same as we used earlier. In this case, we're going to set C as kx minus omega t and b as kx plus omega t. I'm sorry. I'm going to absorb the minus sign. Minus sign is sine of minus. So we're going to set b equal to minus kx minus omega t. So in doing that, I'm just absorbing this minus sign into the argument of the sign. Okay? So now if we take those arguments and we use the trig ID, we end up with y of xt is equal to minus 2a times the sine of 1/2 c plus b. So this plus that is going to be 1/2. The kx is canceled and I get minus 2 omega t. And it's a sine, so the minus sign just pulls out. That's where the minus sign right here comes from. So this will be sine of omega t. And then this part is c minus b, so if I take that and I subtract that, kx minus a minus gives me 2kx, and this term minus that term is 0. Is that we have something that is harmonic in space with a spatial periodicity, and then we see that we have harmonic in time with a time periodicity. But if you want to think about it, think of this as an amplitude that varies in time with omega. Think of this as a fixed pattern in space. This is not a traveling wave. It's not a combination of kx minus omega t. It's a spatial wave fixed as a function of x and an amplitude that varies in time. Okay? This is a term that varies from 0 to 1 in time. This you can think of as the amplitude. So together this is as if you have a time-varying amplitude. And what you have here, oops, is a fixed form in space, periodic in lambda. Because it's fixed in space and its amplitude is just varying, we call these standing waves.
So if I had a source of waves way over there and a source of waves over here, and they were just shooting at each other with the same frequency, same amplitude, you'd end up with this strange sort of form. Okay? That's a little bit hard to set up, especially in a demo. Turns out that the form you usually see is one where you have a traveling wave moving on a string, and the string is fixed at both ends. So what happens is the wave literally travels back and forth. Okay? And the problem with that is you don't have complete freedom to let these waves interfere over infinitely, because you have a reflection, and what's reflecting depends on what the actual amplitude of the wave is at that point when it travels down that way. So what you find is that you get an interesting situation when you have a wave traveling this way that interferes constructively with the wave that travels this way. And when you have that kind of situation, you'll have constructive interference, and basically we'll set up the standing waves because you'll have a resonance at those particular frequencies. So let me just show you, and we'll look at it more. But first we have to figure out how to turn it on. Okay, so if I just have random frequencies going, you get sort of a random jumble, because the waves will sort of add together with different levels of constructive, destructive aspects as they go across. When I hit a situation where the wave traveling this way and the wave traveling that way interfere constructively, then you'll get an interesting situation. You see? Now it's hard to maintain that one. So that's what's known as the fundamental frequency of this string. If I now go to slightly higher frequency, shorter wavelength, then it starts to look more interesting. Okay, I get constructive interference. Now it's not as stable as I'd like with this. If I go to a shorter wavelength, then it's a little more stable. Okay, now you can sort of see this sine, this cosine kx form. And it's a little hard to see here because it sort of feels like this has a full amplitude, but it doesn't. This is an amplitude that's changing in time, which is the sine term, modulating the amplitude. Okay? And the ultimate amplitude that you get turns out, turns out to be twice the amplitude of the incoming wave. So as I increase the frequency, every time I hit a combination of frequency and length such that I can get constructive interference, given the boundary conditions for the reflected wave, then I will get constructive interference. Okay? That's cool. See how high we can go.
So if we look at that quantitatively, imagine that I have a wave traveling this way, and I have a wave that has opposite sign traveling that way. They'll cancel at the middle if you think of them like that. Okay, they'll also add from their different points. But when I have a wave coming in such that 2 times this length is equal to 1 full wavelength, or a way to think about it is I have a half wavelength coming into here, then when it reflects, you'll get constructive interference at the middle. And so, to think about this quantitatively, you can think about if this is distance L, when L is equal to 1/2 lambda, then these two things will add together. When L is equal to lambda, they will also add together, but now they'll add together in such a way that they're always destructive right in the middle. If L is equal to 3/2 lambda, you'll get this form. These things that never move, that is, these are the zero points of that sine kx term, cosine kx term, these are what we call nodes. This is for waves on a string. And these places where you have an amplitude going from zero to twice the amplitude as a function of time, these are things that we call antinodes. So if we were to imagine that this is a musical instrument of some form, what we see is that this string will resonate at lambdas, where the length is equal to m over 2 times lambda, where m is equal to 1, 2, 3, on up. I'll call this lambda sub m. We know that v is equal to lambda times the frequency. So we can substitute it in for lambda as V over the frequency. So L is equal to M over 2 times V over the frequency, where M goes from 1, 2, 3 on up. It's integral. So what it means is that we will get certain frequencies of these waves to resonate on the string, and those frequencies are given by this. And recall that the velocity for a wave moving on a string is the square root of t over mu. So you, if you have a musical instrument, a string instrument, you can change the frequency that you're playing for a given string, for a given mass per unit length. You can excite different modes on the string. This is known as the fundamental vibration, and it will give you the lowest frequency. These are integral multiples of that, and they're called overtones or harmonics. So this is the fundamental. I believe it's also the first harmonic. A musician can help me out here. Second harmonic, third harmonic. Okay? If I want to change the note, if I want to change the frequency, I can tighten the string up. So you tune it by literally tightening it up.
Or I can actually give it a different mask unit length. So you'll notice that strings on certain instruments, you have really light strings and you have heavier strings. And so they literally will give you different ranges. So if I take these waves and I put boundary conditions in, then I get resonances at very particular frequencies. When we get to quantum mechanics and we talk about particles being waves, if we put them in a bound condition, we will get resonances, just like we do here. And those are the quantum states that exist. Things that don't resonate don't exist. So in a very real sense, as we'll see, music is quantized sound. If you want to think of it that way. Any comments, questions? Who's and all? Want me to do this some more? Cool. Alright. We can change the boundary conditions. So again, go to the mirror and start slapping yourself if you start memorizing any of this stuff. I want you to think your way through it using the boundary conditions and what's happening, the phase change, and how they interfere. It's a little, in my mind, sometimes a little hard to think about the boundary condition and how it interferes in this sort of pattern. The mental mnemonic or the mental pattern that I use to follow is I simply draw the simplest one I can have that satisfies the boundary conditions here, which is just fixed at both ends. And I look at this and I go, well, that's a half of the wavelength. The next one that has fixed points at both ends is a full wavelength. The next one is 1.5 wavelengths. And that's sort of the mental way that I think about it. There's probably an easier way to, or a different way of thinking about it, which is where you say, if it travels a distance of 2L and it comes back to the same point, that would be one wavelength. And that is the minimal, that's the longest wavelength you can have where you can satisfy that boundary condition. And then you can have it do integral multiples of that. So you can think your way through it in different ways, perhaps. But the mental model I use is I sort of picture this when I draw it this way, fixed at both ends, and this is the half wavelength, this is the full wavelength, this is 1.5 wavelength. So that usually works. Mm-hmm. So you can imagine if we have an instrument where we have a fixed end and an end where we have a loose string. Now we know that we will have this point fixed, so we always have to interfere destructively. And at this point, you have no phase change, which means you have full amplitude motion here. Okay, so the simplest way to satisfy that would be to have this distance be now a half wavelength, because you want this to have full motion. So, just again, the simplest thing to do is just draw it. So I want to have a node here, and I want to have an antinode here because it's able to have full motion. Then the next level up, is like that. The next level is like that.
So here I have the L is equal to 1/4 lambda. Here I have L is equal to 3/4 lambda. Here I have L is equal to 5/4 lambda. So you can then do the same game we did on the last page, and you find that the frequencies that will play will be M over 2L T over mu, where M is equal to 1, 3, 5. So this instrument would only play oblong ones, we would say. Yes?
Why? Because why would the loop 10 want to be at an end? Why would it?
It's not fixed.
Right, but why would it be anywhere unless it is playing?
If it's just anywhere, then you basically negate the correlation between the incoming and the outgoing, so you don't get a resonance. You have some random crap. Which you noticed in between the frequencies that resonate, you've got a lot of random crap on the string. Because this wave is coming in, and the phase of the wave when it hits here isn't well correlated with the length, in a sense. So what we're looking at are conditions where you will get constructive interference. If you are a tube instrument of a horn, what do you call them? You have strings and horns? Winds. Yeah, wind instruments. My musical prowess comes through again. What you have there is you have waves and pipes, and these are sound waves. So what you have in that case are pressure variations. And we have to sort of figure a way to think about it in the same sense. So in the case of pressure variation, you have something moving longitudinally inside the tube. And at the end of a closed tube, they can't move. So if you want to think about the amplitude of the motion of the molecules in the wave, you would call this a displacement node. If it's an open end, then they're able to move more. You call it a displacement antinode. Turns out that when you think of it in terms of pressure, you have higher pressure at the end, and you have lower pressure for open, and you end up with a node and antinode definition split. So we're going to go through that to start a class. We can do the same kind of game, thinking of the periodicity at the end of tubes, and whether they're open or closed, to basically come up with the frequencies that you can play in your random tubes as well. So, okay? Any questions? All right. See you next week.
Question about the homework. The first problem we're given is a resonance problem. It says we have a spring.